has several missions. One is that we take oral history interviews of members of the bench and bar, and those are available in the Joint Archives, which is another one of our projects. We have a very nice archive of historical materials and also these interviews that's located in the law library at the State Courthouse here in Anchorage in the Boney Building. And we do this annual luncheon. And this year, we're very proud to have Nisha Steinkruger, retired Superior Court judge from Fairbanks. And she'll be talking with us about Morningside Hospital. And she gave me the best biography I've ever seen, so I'm just going to read it for you. Nisha Steinkruger was on the Superior Court bench in Fairbanks for 19 glorious years. It was the best job you could ever want. People came and taught you science, math, sociology, philosophy, ethics, and more science every day. People had the craziest ideas. People helped each other in difficult times. People were brilliant. People were stupid. People said amazing things. Before those 19 years, Nisha practiced law. She worked as a newbie attorney with the private practice law firm of Rice Hoppner during the pipeline days in Fairbanks for 3 years. She worked in the Attorney General's office doing mental commitments and child protection for 4 years. And she worked at the Public Defender's office doing criminal defense, juvenile crime, and mental commitments for 5 years. She worked for Guess and Rudd in private practice before going on the bench. And this Morningside project that she'll be telling you about has been a long-time interest. I'm sure she'll give you some history about how she got into it and all the work she's done and where you can find out even more about it than what you're learning today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Nisha Steinkruger.
Thanks. Thank you. I want to remember to plug the jukebox. Online is a project with the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, Oral History Project. And so you Google Project Jukebox, and you'll find there interviews with judges, interviews with lawyers. There's an interview with a woman who was a cook at Morningside. There's some interviews with a territorial marshal. They're just really fun, and you can get listen to those interviews or get the transcripts with those interviews, and it's just a fabulous project trying to record some of the things that were happening in territorial Alaska. If you the Morningside Blog has links there, and so you'll find more information there. Anybody that finishes their food while I'm talking and wants to move to the front to get a better seat to see the screen, come on down. Well, I got started in this, I guess, about 6 years ago. Some of you know Karen Perdue. She was the former Commissioner of Health and Social Services. She was from Fairbanks, and she started looking for her uncle, who she knew had come back and forth from various mental institutions, and she couldn't find anything. And she got frustrated, and so she put some money together and a group together because there was no patient list anywhere. And I went to the first meeting, and then I kind of drooped around a couple of other meetings, and then I got sucked in. I told her I would give 3 years, I gave five. And now that we have a patient list that we think is about 90-95% accurate, I see my job as going around and telling people this civil rights story so that they can pick up some, like you in the audience, you can pick up other pieces and take them on forward. It really is an Alaskan civil rights story, and it gave us the mental health trust. People were either, as it says, inside Alaska, outside Alaska in the lower 48, or at Morningside, which was a mental hospital in Portland, Oregon. I've talked to people who can remember very well their aunties or their grandma saying when they were little, if you don't straighten up, they're going to come and get you and take you to Morningside. And that was a threat when they were children. These were people with mental illness. It's a story of mental illness, drugs, alcohol, even Scientology is involved. There are stories about immigration and deportation, greed, political deals that were made, and very caring families and advocates. These are people that were miners and storekeepers and subsistence hunters, fishermen, people that came here from other countries to the canneries, and homesteaders. From the late 1800s to 1960, the mentally ill and disabled were diseased Alaskans, that's a term of law, that were found by a jury, guilty or not guilty, and the verdict would read, real and truly insane. They were sent to Morningside Hospital. When we started looking, Morningside burned down in the 70s, and at least we've never found an Alaska territorial government where any list of patients was kept. And it was only at about the third or fourth meeting that we began to wonder, Judge Green, Meg Green and I, if, maybe it's like today when we send people to API. Maybe there's a court order somewhere. And sure enough, that turned out to be the best route. We were using BIA records, we were using census records, other kinds of records trying to put it together. But then we figured out every Alaskan had a court order. Because the only way the federal government would pay the daily rate at a mental institution was if they were ordered by a federal court to do so. So we started looking backwards for court orders. After the verdict, these were six-person juries, after the verdict, people were held either in jail or in some kind of facility, but most of them were in jail. In the territorial years, these courts were mostly commissioners' courts in Eagle, St. Michael, Nome, Fairbanks, Valdez. Anchorage was really sort of the last. And in many smaller places in rural Alaska. And in fact, you find the roots of Alaska's judicial system in rural Alaska in these kinds of cases. Okay, Raj, let's go. This is the facility. These are all sort of staged pictures. We have not found any actual photographs. This was in October of 1914, and it shows you sort of what the hospital looked like. And they had people sleeping on the porch there. Next. And remember, these people didn't commit a crime. These were civil commitments. Here's a picture of the medical director and a group of Eskimo Alaskans, Christmas 1920 at Morningside Hospital. Next. Dr. J.W. Lucky, nurse and patients, Morningside Hospital. Children from north of the Arctic Circle. Always happy at Morningside Hospital. Let's see if I can read this one. Alaska defectives happily housed in the mild climate. Native tubercular children. Women's ward, redecorated with colored drapes. Oh yeah, these living quarters for mental cases under the most favorable conditions. We found patients from age 6 weeks to 96 years. Between 4,000 and 5,000 Alaskans went to Morningside. There were cases of suicide attempts, many head injuries, drugs, way more cocaine and heroin than I would have ever known about. Alcohol, legal and illegal, dementia, epilepsy, and people who could not speak or hear. They were transported by waterway, by dog sled, by stage, by barge, by boats, and later by planes. Some of them were discharged in Portland or to relatives in the lower 48. A few returned to Alaska, but most are buried in Portland cemeteries. They're in pauper graves, both marked and unmarked. We're pretty sure there's one ravine with many people buried in it. As I said, there's no patient list, and so we went to many sources, including the court records. The court records, you'll see, would not just be about a case. These are all handwritten. This is before copies, whiteout, anything. So the only record is what's written in the docket book. But we would, and we literally were down there going page by page through books, looking. And sometimes we would pick them up in a fee book, the Marshall's fee book, because they would have something, it would be labeled a sanity case, and you'd have the fees that were paid to the jurors or to the marshal, and we'd be able to pick someone's name up there. Let's go to the next one, Roger. These are the kind of fee books, and I think really we were very lucky because this is in the old archives and they trusted us. So their usual rule of bringing out one book at a time that you requested, they let us go into this vault where all the court records are on shelves. And there's no index. So because they're archivists, they're on the shelf in the order that they were sent. So they have no order to them. And so we would take these big books and literally go page by page through hundreds and hundreds of them. And they let us work in this garage, which was kind of cool. But they would not let us put them back on the shelf because we were not reliable. So they went by court order. And you would, in a good case, we would find a complaint, the subpoena for the alleged insane person, for the witnesses, appointing a doctor, amazing number saw physicians, appointing an attorney, subpoenas for six jurors to be delivered by the marshals, some evidence recited when the commissioner or a clerk wrote in the book, what the charge was, real and truly insane. And we would get a verdict form. We would find sometimes a verdict form would be stapled in the book, and sometimes it would be copied in a book. But the really fun ones are either handwritten in the book or stapled in the book, and it has the signature of each juror on the verdict form. Then you would have a transport order, and then you'd have a return from the marshal when the marshal returned from Morningside after they delivered the person. There's a couple of great articles which you can get from Maryland that were written by Thomas G. Smith in the Pacific Northwest Quarterly about the treatment of the insane from 1884 to 1939 and detaining the insane in Alaska from 1910 to 1915. They are amazing articles by a guy that's, I've contacted him and he said he's just not interested in that anymore. What to do with the mentally ill in Alaska? We looked to Oregon law to apprehend, but where to put them? There were institutions, mental institutions in the lower 48 and in Europe. There were some treatment in hospitals, but you also remember in this time period, there were no psychiatrists. You know, this was not a well-known medical process. Alaska had no place to put insane people, and the feds refused to provide any to the territory. So the poor judges, marshals, local law enforcement would pick people up to keep them from freezing or from hurting themselves or others. This may remind you of some things today. and they didn't know what to do with them. So for safety, they would put them in jail, but there was no basis to put them in jail, and the feds would not pay them for that day in jail for that person. They got creative and started charging them with disorderly conduct, but the sentences then were very short, and they couldn't keep people to protect them. There was a judge in Sitka, yes, who decided he'd had enough, and he had an insane person in the jail, and he entered an order for a marshal to transport the person to the government hospital for the insane in Washington, D.C., and bill the feds. And the bill was $1,121.05 in 1889. That got their attention. It's thereafter, in the 1890s, marshals, governors, attorneys, judges started bombarding D.C., and there's wonderful correspondence telling the feds that they needed help. They would use the legal device that they couldn't keep someone in jail if they were insane because they wouldn't get any federal dollars. So they'd convict them of a misdemeanor, sentence them, and when their sentence was up, they'd declare them insane, and then they would enter orders for the federal to transport them to DC and other places in the lower 48 for medical care. So, finally, Governor Brady in 1897 said, "This is so wrong." And a grand jury convened in 1899 in Sitka and asked Congress, quote, "In the name of humanity, to provide means to care for unfortunate insane in our jails." There were three main courts in St. Michael and Juneau and Eagle. And the governor of Alaska put out a bid with some support from the state for a contract for an asylum west of the Rockies. And the lowest bid would get the care and custody of Alaska's insane. Clark's Hospital in Stockton, California bid $25 per person per day. The Oregon State Insane Asylum bid $13 a day. The Department of Interior wrote a letter to the Oregon Hospital and asked them to reread the conditions to be sure they could do it, and then they agreed to $20 a day. There were horrendous problems, as you can imagine, after a court order. Trying to transport someone who has a mental illness in the winter, breakup, paperwork was required. There were no fax machines. There was no scanning. So having people's paperwork and signature, there was a very difficult double transport system that the governor had to sign and the judge had to sign, and this paper had to go around the state. It was really difficult, and this contract was only for 1 year. By the time you got people there, the contract was up. Oregon got full and didn't refuse to continue after 1904. In 1903 and 4, Dr. Coe in Portland began to care for insane patients. And it was in his home, which then became the facility. And he, let's put number 11 up. I'm tired of looking at myself. And he, it was known under many names. You'll see them in the works. The Sanitarium Company, Crystal Springs Sanitarium, Mount Tabor, and then Morningside. And there were also sort of shifting places where this was around the Portland area. He bid $40 a person, and that was too high, and it was negotiated down. There was really a lot of kind of insider deals between politicians and Dr. Coe with these contracts that I haven't followed. But he eventually did a deal with the government for $30 a day, and a multi-year contract, a five-year contract. The Nelson Act in 1905, can you go back to 89 and just put the people up again, began a jury of six male adults being required, set the legal requirement of real and truly insane, required a lawyer at the trial, required one or more physicians, required testimony, and required a unanimous verdict. I have to say, when I started into this project, I thought I would see people railroaded to Morningside. But it just warmed my little judge's heart to see that there was more due process than I thought. Everybody had a court-appointed lawyer. And we found a few cases, like on Little Diomede, where there wasn't a lawyer, but they would appoint a school teacher or someone. But most everyone has a lawyer. And almost all the cases, the person was seen by a physician, which also, I mean, there wasn't much physicians could do, but still, it just warmed my heart. And then we saw insane or sane, and we saw verdicts of sane. And so this was being taken carefully by jurors, just like you want. In 1905, the Alaska Fund was created. This is the beginning of the Mental Health Trust. The Alaska Fund was created, and it was the feds collecting fees from liquor licenses, cigar licenses, cigarette licenses, all kinds of occupations and trades, and you see these in the territorial records. That money mostly went for roads and schools, but 5% of it went to the insane. One of the things about this story is there was no confidentiality in these cases, so there are just many newspaper articles about people coming and going. There are letters and stories. Thomas Clark, who was a territorial governor in 1911, there were people writing letters to the editor from Morningside, people complaining about the care there. And this governor, bless his heart, got on a plane, went to Morningside in 1911 to see what was going on there and what was happening to Alaskans. He talked about getting some changes in the food and some changes in the care for people, but at least he went. There's a wonderful, the Nome Nugget, which is one of my favorite newspapers in Alaska, right? In Nome, the city council just got up in arms in about 1916. They were getting letters back from people that were at Morningside. And they started publishing them and sending them to newspapers around the country. And as can only happen in Nome, they got affidavits from people at Morningside, and they started printing them in the paper and demanding that someone do something. I'm going to read you a little bit out of one of them. I will here relate a little of my own experience. A short time before I went into the kitchen to cook one day, while I was walking around the grounds near the side porch, I heard Jimmy Cryon calling for help from someone. And knowing him as I did here in Nome, before going to the institution, I immediately went up on the porch where the attendants had put handcuffs on him and tied him flat on his back on a rack made of lumber about 2 1/2 feet high, 6 1/2 feet long, and 3 feet wide, made something like a couch, and I at once inquired what the cause of such outcry from him. And he stated that he wanted to go to the toilet at once as he was suffering badly with pain. And he asked me to untie him and to go to the toilet with him, and as soon as he got relief, he would come right back to me and allow me to tie him up again. All of which he did as promised. But someone must have seen me release Mr. Cryon and reported it to the attendants. For in a very short time thereafter, the superintendent and 4 attendants grabbed me and threw a towel around my neck and began twisting it until it choked me down, and they began to beat and kick me until I became unconscious. And I carried the marks and bruises on my head and body and limbs for months. Then they dragged me without anything to eat for several days. I have also seen a great many other patients treated in the same manner as they treated me. The sanitary conditions of this institution is something awful, and it's just reeking in filth. It cannot be otherwise, for the patients are crowded in a very small space, and the attendants do not try to keep it clean. One of the letters from Edward J. Fox that was included in the Gnome Nugget concludes, "I broke out of Morningside, and I am now working steadily, and if I had remained, I would have been cremated." People were detained until they were transported. Hawaii and Puerto Rico and the Philippines, other territories, had asylums, and the Alaskans railed about this. There was this strong feeling in Washington, D.C. that it was a good idea to be sending Alaskans to Portland because the weather was bad in Alaska, and it was dreary, and it was dark, and it was just not a healthy place for people to be. It was better for them to go to Portland. And so the sentiment was very much in D.C. that they should. It was for Alaskans' benefits that they were sending them outside. They were detained until they were transported, frequently in the jails. If you think about it, trails, waterways had to be taken care of. Let's go forward, Rod. This is a detention house that was finally built in Fairbanks. There was one built in Fairbanks and one built in Nome to 10th and Turner, Mr. Cook. Fairbanks and Nome, where people could stay that wasn't a jail. And it was a long struggle between Clark and Wickersham in D.C. to get these built. However, the one in Nome never opened. It became a place for school teachers to live. The one in Fairbanks was open for a very brief period, and then there was an audit and an inspection. It took $7,500 a year to operate the one in Fairbanks. If they took that times two with Nome, that came to $35,000. And it only costs twice that much, including transportation, to maintain the 150 patients or more that were Alaskans at Morningside. So the feds, does this remind you of prisons in any way? The feds figured out it was much cheaper to ship people out to Morningside than to operate a facility in Alaska. The Fairbanks one did open for about 4 or 5 years. Photographs, telegrams of the women's toilet that didn't work, the hellhole attic of a jail where women were being kept, neighbors complaining about being able to hear people screaming in the top of the jail, finally got the Fairbanks one open. But there was constant bickering about the money. It was at 10th and Turner, and eventually it closed because the feds would not support it. Well, these are just some really fun newspaper articles I'm going to show you right now. Here's a transport one. This is December 1911. Six insane and one criminal. Not enough snow for the runners and wheels are used once more. This is the ore stage going out of Fairbanks. Taking prisoners. Connections will be made with the Alameda boat leaving Cordova on December the 6th. You'll see it tells you the names, Samuel Bonifield, Gilbert Dionne, gives you the names of the people. They'll be taken to Mount Tabor Asylum. Then they have one prisoner going to McNeil's Island, and it names the guards and the marshal. So it was very common to see these in the newspaper. Insane patients soon to go outside. Marshall Love is perfecting arrangements to send the four unfortunates to Oregon asylums as soon as grand jury takes action on Ms. Blanche Duvall. Have you seen, I love that name, Blanche Duvall. And Michael Carey does a wonderful Blanche Duvall history story. She shot the sheriff. I mean, it's just a wonderful story. They're looking for people to go along. It names all the people that are there. Mr. Love, the marshal, stated that he would deputize such guards as wanted to go outside and were willing to undertake the delicate task of handling the patients. These men will, of course, be paid their expenses and a per diem for the trip, and affords an opportunity for those who are desirous of getting out if they are of sufficient responsibility to meet the marshal's requirements. This is the stage, and so you can see the look at all the furs in there, how people were being transported, and then the story about they came back to put the runners on because the wheels were getting stuck. There are great stories. Guilford Kriska was Karen Perdue's uncle. She remembered him. He's from a village on the Yukon. And she remembered the family would talk about him, and she can remember seeing him. It took me a while to figure this out. He eloped from Morningside, and we would see eloped a lot. And at first I thought, like, what, they ran off and got married? No, you know, they ran away from Morningside. They got out. Several times, she remembers he came back to Fairbanks and was deinstitutionalized when Morningside sent people back, and he died in the jail in Fairbanks. We've had two families in the interior that have been able to find their loved one, if they can find a marked grave. But it is Portland, so, you know, plants grow over those little markers, and so it's quite a bit of work. But James Ibana, his family found him, and they were able to take him out of the Portland cemetery, and he's from Anvik, and they took him back to Anvik and buried him with the family. And there's another family in the interior that has done the same. But, you know, they heard these stories in their family, but there was shame involved. And so being able to do this is a pretty big deal for people. Can you go back to number 12, Roger? Sam Bonifield is one I've enjoyed. Sam was in the paper fairly often. Yeah, he's being transported down there. And I love this description. Sam Bonifield was a professional gambler and a saloon owner who followed the gold from Dawson City to Fairbanks in the 1900s. Sam and his brother founded the First National Bank of Fairbanks, which shipped out $3 million in gold dust before the Depression hit. Bonifield was known as Square Sam because he treated people fairly, took the near failure of the bank very hard, and he was despondent and had a nervous breakdown, kneeling in the snow in front of the bank, crying, "Oh God, please show me the way out." He went to Morningside twice, and the newspapers talk about the banker that went to Morningside and came back two different times. Okay, let's go to number 16, honey. If I haven't introduced my fabulous IT guy, his name is Roger Bruner. We will have been married 40 years next month, and he's the best. Here's an example of the kind of newspaper stories that you would see. Kowalski insanity case. Isn't he? Yes, one-eyed Shaw Creek Tony. One-eyed Shaw Creek Tony, not satisfied with decision of lower court, who was adjudged insane by a jury in the commissioner's court, has decided to carry the case to the district court. Demented man has his trial before jury. So you can see people in the community knew about these things. Next one. These are the kind of docket books. They're hard to read. There's some examples on your table there, but the copies didn't work out very well. Here's a 1903 from Juneau, December 15th, 1903. Mary Squaw from Juneau. And she went, this was on the early contract, she went to the Oregon State Insane Asylum. Next. Look at the penmanship. Doesn't it just warm your heart? in the matter of the inquiry as to the mental condition of Frank Nigg, a lunatic. This is 1901. He is insane and liable to do injury to the public unless restrained and apprehended. So that's where a court order exists, is right there. Next. Oh, I had to just throw in some fun things from the archive so you could just see other besides sanity case. In the matter of the delivery of 1 pint of brandy by the United States Marshal to Dr. D.H. Devine at Juneau, Alaska. This is so fun. This is during Prohibition, so this is 1925. That is, in order to save the life of one John Heitman, a patient in St. Anne's Hospital at Juneau, Alaska, it is necessary to procure and administer a brandy stimulant. Save the life. And it is further appearing to the court that there is no brandy in the town of Juneau, excepting certain bottles of brandy in the custody of the United States Marshal at Juneau, heretofore seized and held as evidence and for condemnation. It is therefore ordered that 1 pint of said brandy, so held by the United States Marshal, be delivered for administration to said patient. Look, that is good stuff. Next. Here's an example of a fee record. This would be like a fee book. And we would look through and we'd find at the top, in the matter of the inquiry of the sanity of Susie Harris. See, there's her attorney listed there. G.C. Wynn, looks like, W-I-N-N. And then you can see the federal court would collect fees. That's how they existed. And so you've got the complaint taken, 85 cents, commitment, jury order, judgment, and then I love these clerks. I totally love these clerks because when someone died at Morningside, they would send a letter back to the court, and it's really hard to find those. But the best clerks would write, take the letter, go back and make an entry. November 15th, 1948, notice of death and burial of patient on November 6, 1948. Fabulous information for a family. So when you got a clerk that did that, it was great. Next one. And I love this clerk because at the front of a docket book, this clerk made a list by type of case what was in the docket book. So this whole page is sanities. And so we could just take the list. It was like an index. Few and far between, but fabulous. Next. This is just to throw in, I threw this in because it's fun. This is an accounting for a funeral. Kishon Cove, Alaska, 1940. One piece of 12 ounces of canvas, 6x6, $1.80. Manila rope for handles on the box, 85 cents. Lumber and nails for the box, $1.90. Labor for construction, $5. Total cost for preparing the body for burial, $9.55. Found in a, you know, would be in a probate record. The next few are of a Fairbanks and a homeless street person that lived in Fairbanks most of the years that I've been there, and I found her file. Roger found it. The actual file, not in a docket sheet, but there are in the record sometimes the actual court file. And sometimes they're in, you know, those envelopes, kind of like wills were folded in. Sometimes you'll find the file in those. And this is Irene Sherman. Irene was 15 then, and this shows you what the medical certificates look like that the docs filled out. And it would have her name, her age, her occupation, her religion, her telegraph address. Other relatives, it lists mother insane, now in asylum, father in Fairbanks. He was a minor. So she's 15 years old in Juneau. Were parents addicted to excessive alcohol, opium, or other narcotics? Habits of the patient as to same, temperate. Previous peculiarities of patient as to temper and conduct. Perverted mind sexually. Has patient had epilepsy, apoplexy, syphilis? Lots of people with syphilis in Morningside. Syphilis, tuberculosis, heat exhaustion, or other serious physical diseases. Irene was badly burned as a child. Next question. Evidence of sexual excess or abnormal sexual habits. History of previous attacks, if any. Always has been weak, never has been okay mentally. When and how did the symptoms first manifest? Evident for several years. No history of medical change. Chiefly of underdeveloped mind, also has a perverted mind, which is undoubtedly inherited. Next page. And then there were special questions for females. Number of children, age of youngest, number of miscarriages, date of last one. Has patient had any uterine or ovarian disease? What menstrual irregularities, if any? I'm not a physician, but lots of what I suspect to be postpartum depression going to Morningside. And then here you can see on Irene Sherman's, here's a verdict form. This is because I had the actual file of this one, I could copy the actual file. And see, look here, they say, not real and truly insane, and she ought not to be committed to the sanitarium or asylum. And then all the jurors signed their name. And this one warms my heart because at the bottom, the jurors passed on their wisdom. We recommend Irene Sherman be confined in some institution for the feeble-minded, such probably Medical Lake, Washington, or some similar institution. 1926. Next page. There's little tiny books, and some of them are villages. So one of my dreams is to go back and photograph those books and tell the villages about these records. For example, you'll see Probate Court, Eagle Precinct, 1901 to 1942. So there's lots of information for villages that's never been mined. And who couldn't resist opening this, right? Inquest docket, 1909 to 1944. You want to read those stories, don't you? Next, just to show you how many strange things there are, disbursement record number 2, Alaska Pioneer Home. Next. Record of fur license and pelt tax collections, 1925 to 1926. Probate and coroner's record. Don't you want to read the coroner's records? Fort Yukon, Alaska. And the next one I have on, there's some copies on the table. I don't know how well you can read them, but we had to really focus to stay on our mission because I want to read the inquest stories. And the great thing about the inquest, like this one, Dick Morris came to the marshal's office at 5:40 p.m. on July 26, 1945, Thursday, and reported he had no response from knocking on Fred DeMar's door, and his blinds were still drawn and suspected all was not well. So Marshal Richard A. Brown went down with Dick Morris, and when not getting any response from their knocks, looked in partly opened window and could see Fred DeMars in bed, partly dressed, and decided to go back and report to the commissioner and get Dr. Disaway. Together, the commissioner, Dr. Disaway, the marshal, and Dick Morris went down to Fred's, and in the presence of the commissioner and the doctor, the marshal, and Dick Morris broke open the back door and upon entering found Fred DeMars lying on his back in his bed, and Dr. Disaway made examination there, pronounced dead. So the next step after that is the commissioner would order the marshal to go get six people for a coroner's inquest. And those six people would go to the site of the body. I mean, it's great forensics, right? And you know, I've read some of these in Southeast Alaska where they go down and you know there's a body laying in a boat, or there's a body on the beach, or there's a body out in the snow somewhere. And the six people rounded up would go to the site, stand there, have a discussion about what happened, and decide if it was natural causes or someone had a homicide. And then they would just record that. And that was your inquest. Next one, the adoption records are everywhere. I think many of us have understood that there were many, most Native adoptions were not recorded. We found hundreds of recorded Native adoptions where Native families would take in a child that was part of the family, but they would go to the commissioner's office and have it recorded. So I suspect there are many records out there that people don't know about. This one is an adoption by two white people in Galena, and it is in 1949. But there are many, many adoption records. Lots of probate records. I mean, people that had nothing. There was a probate record. Here's a probate record, the death of Little William of Koyukuk. All his property, someone rounded up his property. It was recorded at the commissioner's. This was $15.50 were being paid out for the person to go to Koyukuk and round up the property. This is 1935. He had a dresser, a spring bed, and a trunk. And there's a recording that it was delivered to the relatives. This is a typical sanity case that we would see with the dates on the left, the cost for things, and then what was happening on the right. And as things got rolling, it was not unusual to see them happen in one day. There's one happening in one day where a complaint would be filled out. Subpoenas would be issued and delivered. Jurors would be marshaled. They'd come in. The person would, lawyer was appointed. The jurors would come in. A physician would see the person, and they would have a hearing. Warmed my heart, as in this case, to see that interpreters were frequently used in addition to lawyers and doctors. This is sanity of, yes, Sander Koski. These are the kind of records that we would get excited when we'd see. This is actually an onion skin, you know how letters were on onion skin, that's been stapled into the book over the written proceedings. Clerks again. And so when this letter came in, the clerk went and stapled it in the book about that person's sanity. And this is, this person was admitted in 1934. These are the best records you can find, because Morningside would write a letter and they'd tell you when the person was committed, where they were from, and when they died. So this person was committed from Dillingham in 1955. Tells you when they died. Sometimes it tells you the cemetery. It was my impression that he had possibly sustained a coronary occlusion. The main findings were barely perceptible something. Blood pressure was not obtainable. He improved some after admission to the infirmary. Almost all of them had autopsies. I don't know what that was about. The autopsy, this man failed to reveal significant findings for cause of death. Senile exhaustion. I kind of like that. Was finally, and then see, you can see over here the signed verdict that was in there. So if you can find those letters, it really tells people a lot about what happened. Here we are working away in the garage at the archives. Telegrams were really fun. Sometimes they're stapled in to the book where the person's record is. Moses Koenig, veteran of World War II. There's his serial number, believed to be insane, now under my jurisdiction. Brother desires veteran to be treated at VA hospital. Was in Barrow. Deputy will arrive as soon as possible from Kotzebue and take patient into custody and transfer to Nome. So you can see what happened to somebody. This is Jumbo Koturek, yes. This is 1929. You know, defense lawyers got good at getting the doctor, as time went by, the doctor to examine, maybe hold the person at the hospital, or sometimes the hospital actually was the doctor's house, and they learned how to do what we love, right? Continuances. And so sometimes, it's just like now, right, Peter? Continuance, the person would sober up, or the person, they could do something to help the person with withdrawal. And if they could buy time, then the person didn't go to Morningside. This one is over a course of 4 months. And then get the doctor to come in, and the person is no longer insane. So it kept them from going to Morningside. I'm going to finish with just a kind of fun story that actually Roger is a big fan of. Some of these I can't tell, there just isn't enough time. And this is a World War II story about Stanford Johnson in July of 1942 at Dutch Harbor. He was on the Northwestern, which was a boat where they were housing Navy personnel. And you'll see there's some pages there, but they didn't copy very well. And the actual testimony is in the docket book, so it's a fun one to read. The ship was bombed, and he ran to the hospital and said his hip was broken. He said he was on the Northwestern when it was bombed, that the bomb, imagine this, the bomb went right past him, knocked him down, and exploded three decks below. And it blew his mind. He was never the same. Is he a drinking man? No. They tried to care for him. He did not sleep. He was very violent. We put him in a straitjacket. He was talking all the time. The most he slept was 17 minutes. I do not think he's faking because he talks so rapidly. Just a clutter of talk all the time, which a sane person could hardly do. And he talked about Fern. He would say, "She's going to wait for me." Then he would cry, and he would look at the light and cover his eyes and swing his arms. He would run up and try to scare the person through the hole in his cell. "He hit me on the nose. He twisted the identification chain around my neck in the scuffle, and I hit him in the mouth, and he spit blood on me. He yells all through the night, and after daylight, when others are moving around, making some noise, he quiets down." And here is the first Anders brief. His lawyer said, at the very end of the proceeding, "I think with Dr. Kearns that only treatment will help this person. I believe the patient is not only dangerous to himself, but to others as well. I recommend the jury find the patient in need of treatment and be sent to a proper institution. Here's a picture of the Northwestern that he was on when it was bombed in Dutch Harbor. Did you do the other one? Here's a picture of the smoke and the bombs at Dutch Harbor. From Morningside to API, in the 1950s, the Interior Department and Alaskans were vigorously looking for an alternative to Morningside. In 1959, there was a federal tour in Alaska from the Housing, Interior, and Insular Affairs Committee, and they took testimony all over Alaska, and you can read this testimony. And one of the ones that testified was Ted Stevens. He was a U.S. attorney then, and he talked about this very dark ages practice and how much he hated representing the government in these Morningside hearings. Bob Bartlett got Edith Green of Portland, who turns out to be a real champion for closing Morningside. She was in Congress to support him, and they passed the Alaska Mental Health Bill. The great part is the opposing this bill was a right-wing conspiracy theory. And this theory was that the new law, and Scientology was very big at pushing this theory all over the United States in the press. It was going to authorize the federal government to put concentration camps in Alaska, this mental health bill. And there would be political prisoners sent by the federal government to this mental institution in Alaska. And Scientology, which is very anti-psychiatric, was a big pusher in this, and it's really fun to read their sort of exposés that they published. Barry Goldwater was in the Senate, and he stripped everything out of this bill, and all the regulations, everything, and gave the territory the legislative power to handle Alaska's mentally ill, and a 1 million-acre grant to pay for mental health services. In 1956, we finally got the Alaska Mental Health Enabling Act with the 1 million acres, and the legislature was to set up the trust, but of course they abolished it. And it wasn't then until 86 maybe, that we had Weiss versus State of Alaska filed by Steve Cooper, who later became governor, signed to Judge Green, which eventually required the reconstitution of the trust with land and money. In the end, in the 1960s, people were ordered returned from Morningside to Harborview, but then the tsunami hit about that time in Valdez, and it became very up in the air what happened to people. I've interviewed a couple of people that were still very elderly and at the Denali Center, and there are still people around Alaska, some in adult foster care, who were at Morningside. But it's on the backs of these patients, these lost Alaskans, that we have come where we are today in Alaska for mental health care. Couple of observations. Deportation, when people, many from the canneries, because we had a lot of immigrants from, you know, gold mining, canneries, all these places, the federal government required anyone that wasn't a naturalized United States citizen or born here to be put on a boat back to the country they came from. And they summarily deported insane people back to their countries. More due process, as I've said, than I anticipated. I was surprised to see the confidentiality or lack of confidentiality and things in the newspaper. And it makes me wonder about our assumption that confidentiality is good. It makes me question that because I see the shame that goes along with that. It reminds me of our present use of jails and looking for places for mentally ill people. It reminds me that we're still struggling with the conflicting values of individuality and freedom versus providing help under mandatory orders. The need for medical treatment and still how hard it is to provide treatment in the community. Shelter, still an issue because it's cold here. The decisions we make and how we make it mandatory. We've come full circle in many ways to being with the same problems today. There are these two wonderful men down in Portland who have developed an interest with us. They live there, David Anderson and Eric Cordingly, and you'll see them. And they look for grave sites of people from Morningside and help document. And they've been very good at, there's four cemeteries, at trying to find records that were kept by cemetery personnel. Marilyn, can I get you to pass those around to the tables? The last one, there's a website, www.morningsidehospital.com, and there's a blog there where people who are looking for family members or stories that we find are put on there. And there's a rudimentary database. And what Judge Green and I tried to do, it's not fancy, is you can search by name, and you always want to check because there's different spellings. You can search by name, and then it will tell you the numbers where we found that name. So if someone wanted to look at it, they could go to the archives and look where that is, and there might be a few notes of what we found. So it's a really good place to look, along with the jukebox. I thank the Mental Health Trust because they paid my airfare and my hotel to go to Juneau on this project. And what I'm passing out now, for those of you that know me, is a to-do list. My job, yeah, he knows. My job, I see my job now as telling people this story so that they can do other things. But there are many other things to be done. For example, we have mandatory Alaska history in our high schools. The story of the lost Alaskans is a perfect little place to do, you lawyers out there, to develop a forensic piece with these documents that will hook kids rather than just telling them the story, a forensic piece to hook them and included in that curriculum for Alaska high school kids as a piece of history. People talk about a monument. Where would we put something that people would see it and remember these people? Work needs to be done to draft, good lawyer work, draft a letter for the Mental Health Trust to send to the cemeteries, reminding them that these are Alaskan graves and they may not resell. Multiple burials, they cannot do those kinds of things. They have to protect those graves. So there's work to be done, and I invite you to consider the list. It's been a pleasure to share with you this morning. It's the Lost Alaskans is just a great piece of Alaska history, and it's very meaningful when you start talking about it. You'll keep running into people who will tell you they have a relative. My mom, my aunt, my grandpa went to Morningside, and it really connects people. Thank you for coming today. It was my fun.